Hi, everybody. Today is Friday, June 27th, 2025, and our friends, Ambassador Chas Freeman and Professor Marandi, are back with us. Welcome back.
Glad to be with you.
I'm going to start, Ambassador, with what has happened in the case of the conflict, the war between Iran and Israel, and the ceasefire. Last time we talked, you mentioned that there is no ceasefire, some sort of both parties just stopped. It's some sort of cessation of what was happening before. How do you find the way that Donald Trump is trying to picture the situation for the public opinion in the United States, in the world? Is that gonna, do you find it that as time goes by, we're gonna go to get some sort of permanent ceasefire?
I doubt it, unfortunately. I think the Israelis are implacable. I think they learned a hard lesson during this exchange, and that was that they cannot win a war of attrition with Iran. Donald Trump's ego is very large. He immediately announced a fantastic success in the American assault on Iran. He's resisting expert assessments of the actual battle damage, which appears to be considerably less than what he claimed. I mean, I think Iran was battered, yes. Iran's nuclear program was trimmed back, yes. But I think everything I've seen suggests that Fardoh actually survived. The uranium was moved before the attack occurred. It's intact somewhere in Iran. The principal result of the attack seems to have been a disaster for the Non-Proliferation Treaty as international law, the removal of the IAEA inspectors from Iran, the severance of a relationship with Rossi, who turns out to have been collaborating with the Israelis and the Americans and providing information that was essential to assassinate Iranian nuclear scientists, at least. But I don't think the Israelis believe Donald Trump, his claims that Iran has been effectively disarmed. And my own understanding of this, which Mohammed may well correct, is that the Iran is able to produce ballistic missiles at a rate that is faster than Israel and the United States can produce interceptors. What's more, the ballistic missiles are cheaper than the interceptors. A single THAAD firing, for example, is $30 million. So there was a huge amount of money spent on both sides. But if the war had gone on, Israel was going to run out of interceptors, which is, I believe, why they accepted Donald Trump's request that they engage in a ceasefire. And here, my understanding, and again, Mohammed, I invite your correction, is that at the very outset of the conflict, the actual war, because the conflict has been going on for quite a while, Iran declared that it would cease fire if Israel did. And so what Qatar was able to do as the intermediary was to ask Iran, do you stand by that statement? Are you prepared, if Israel stops firing at you, to engage in a ceasefire? And I think they got yes for an answer. But the Israelis agreed with Donald Trump's request for a ceasefire after a bit of negotiation. And I think in their case, two things. First, they had come to recognize that in a war of attrition, they were going to lose because Iran would be, they would run out of interception capability long before Iran ran out of the ability to strike them. And Iran was striking them very, very hard. We've seen reports in Israel that were immediately suppressed by the military censors, but which appeared briefly, that almost 33,000 claims have been filed for property damage. There was a lot of damage done. It was done not just to civilian infrastructure, but to military bases and strategic infrastructure, for example, the refinery in Haifa. And had this gone on, in addition to Haifa being essentially shut down as a port, Ashdod might have been shut down. So I think the Israelis looked at this situation and realized that the better course would be the ceasefire. But they have not ended their ambitions with regard to Iran. They have not agreed to abandon them. And this brings me to the last observation, which is the irony that it's in everyone's interest for Donald Trump, Donald Trump's claim to be accepted by the Israelis, because then they wouldn't have any excuse for another attack on Iran. But I fear that they don't accept it. I think they're more realistic than that. And so what I expect to have happen now is both sides will reconstitute themselves. Iran will rebuild its air defenses, likely with Russian or Chinese or both helping. The missiles, I note that Iran uses, apparently use Beidou, the Chinese version of GPS, as a guidance system. The chips are from China and so forth. The guidance systems are from China. So China has been supplying dual use equipment to Iran. It did not stop. I think it may now take another step and agree to replenish the Iranian air defenses. And I think that may have been discussed in Moscow between Araghchi and the Russians. So Iran will reconstitute itself as rapidly as it can. On the Israel side, the United States will try to replenish Israel. But we have got a serious bottleneck in terms, that is, the United States has a serious bottleneck in terms of depletion of stock and factory capacity that is not adequate to support the multiple conflicts we're in. One of the consequences of this war is to increase the pressure on the Trump administration to abandon Ukraine, because they don't have the weaponry. So I don't think this solved anything. I think it just kicked the can down the road. I think both sides have learned something from it. I should make one final observation, if I may, and that is that one of the consequences of this war is the establishment of a new pattern of surprise attack. That is to say, Israel combined a cyber attack with the pre-placement by agents of armed drones in the vicinity of Iran's air defenses, and it was able to do great damage to Iran's air defenses in the first minutes of the attack. It also, with armed drones, was able to carry out assassinations of military and civilian nuclear personnel, at the expense, by the way, of killing their families and everyone else in the apartment buildings where they were lodged. So we've now got a pattern established. It first came about in the case of Ukraine's attack on the Russian bomber fleet, using the same technique, pre-placement of armed drones and next to the facilities, and their release by agents within communications distance of them. And we've seen it now with the Israeli attack on Iran. So this is a variant on the horrible attack on Hezbollah with civilian pagers, which was clearly an act of terrorism. I don't know how to describe the attack on Iran this manner. It was part of a war. The war itself is illegal. This was an unprovoked attack, and it was a surprise attack. And it was a day that, as Franklin Roosevelt said of Pearl Harbor, will live in infamy. And I'll end here.
Professor Morandi.
Yes, I agree with what Chaz says. And it's clear that this is not the end of the story, and that the Israeli regime will again launch an attack in the future, and the Iranians are expecting that. What has changed, though, is that the Iranians they won't be caught off guard again. The Israelis, they have equipment and technology that Ukraine never had. They have the best of the best that the Americans and the Europeans have to offer. And so Iran has obtained good knowledge about its capabilities. And in addition to that, these collaborators that have been working with the Israeli regime, which are, many of them are not Iranian. Iran has millions of refugees and illegal immigrants or unregistered immigrants, however you'd like to call it. A lot of them were from that very large community, a very respected community, overwhelmingly very good people. But in any case, some of them are of this Takfiri, Wahhabi, Salafi ideology, close to the extremist elements of the Taliban, the more extreme elements, or ISIS and Al-Qaeda. And these people have been cooperating with the Israelis. Large numbers of people have been arrested. So I don't think the Israeli regime will have the sort of advantage that it had this time round with its blitzkrieg attack next time round. The Iranians obviously are going to swiftly prepare themselves for the next round. And so anyone who thinks that this is over, I think that they are naive. The Israelis never abide by ceasefires. They have no red lines. They kill at will. They bomb apartment blocks and bring down the whole apartment block. They'll kill everyone inside if they're seeking a single person. That's how they function. So that's one thing. So I think that the next round will be more difficult for the Israeli regime than this round. Another important factor, I think, is that we're going to see a funeral in Tehran tomorrow. We've seen funerals across the country, but tomorrow we're going to see a big funeral. And, you know, in the West, think tankers, the Western media, they've been saying for years, the U.S. State Department, their analysts, their experts, my friends who are sometimes involved in some of these meetings or these seminars, they always say that Iran is about to implode. The regime, as they like to call it, is hated and despised, and it's corrupt and it's imploding. And then all we have to do is give it a push and it's finished. Well, I think that over the past couple of weeks, we've seen the exact opposite, and that what the world has seen, that not only is the Islamic Republic of Iran popular among the population, but it has become much more popular. And the whole country has rallied behind the armed forces and the leader and the government. And if anything, people have been protesting, why did we accept the cessation of hostilities? And you're right, it wasn't a ceasefire. But many people were saying we should have continued. It wasn't the other way around. And I think tomorrow's funeral, the size I predict will be massive. And although I'm pretty sure that Western media will try not to cover it, and they'll say thousands of people, or at most they'll say tens of thousands of people participated. But I think those who are seriously interested in the interests of the United States or the interests of their countries in Europe, they will know that that they've made a colossal mistake. Many younger Iranians who did not see the revolution, who did not see the Shah gunning down his army, gunning down people on the streets, or did not see Saddam Hussein invade the country, and who are very much influenced by Western narratives, Persian media broadcast by Western governments. Many of these young Iranians who thought that we're too stubborn, it's really our fault, we should be friendly with the United States and compromise, and the solution is out there for us to find. That class of young people, their whole worldview has been shattered. And they have become, they've become very different. Within over hours, not even days, over a few hours, everything has changed. And I have not seen, and I've said this before, I've not seen unity in Iran like this since the 1980s, when Saddam invaded Iran. I've never seen such a situation like this. And people contact me who I would never have imagined, or stop me on the streets, mm-hmm. who I would never have imagined would do so, and say, you're speaking on our behalf, or you know, people from across the street, they would yell and say, wait, and then they'd come to this side of the street and say, you know, be tough, be firm. It's a whole new situation. And I think this is probably the biggest miscalculation of all. So Trump, inadvertently, he has strengthened Iran. Netanyahu, he has strengthened Iran. And actually, Trump makes it easy. I mean, if it was in the era of Obama, he probably would have conducted himself differently. And he would at least try to use soft power. But what Trump does is that it seems as if he goes out of his way to make the United States despise. And Netanyahu, of course, doesn't need to go out of his way to make Israel despise.
So I noted, if I may name it, that there was an Israeli commentator who said that Netanyahu was the most despicable Jew in history. So it's not just Iranians and many Americans who have a negative view of the man, but many others. Well, at least Marandi won't have to listen to VOA Persian service anymore, because Mr. Trump has gutted it. I note also that his reaction to the assassinations was unbelievably vulgar and cruel, when he noted that some of the people who would have turned up in Muscat would not be there because they were dead. And he seemed pleased by that. I want to make a number of very quick points, if I may. One of the focuses, or perhaps the major focus, of the Israeli war on Iran was to produce regime change as a means of getting rid of the nuclear program. Which I think, first of all, is a fundamental miscalculation from the outset, because if you did produce regime change, if it were a non-theocratic regime that came in, it would be a nationalist regime, and the constraints on building a nuclear weapon would, I think, very quickly disappear. And in fact, they may disappear anyway with the succession to Khamenei, who is of an age where he is planning his succession. I'm very much aware at 82, 4 years younger than he, that my time on this earth is limited. And I'm sure he's aware of the same thing. So then we come to the question of what does regime change or a succession of leadership produce when it's brought about by assassination or some other nefarious means? And I think the record is very, very clear. It generally produces a more hardline nationalist leader, often of less competence, lesser competence than the one who's been murdered. I'm thinking of Mo Xinjiang in South Vietnam, for example. But I could give you many other examples. And I think if we were seriously thinking about the lessons of this exchange of missiles and bombs, we would have to admit that regime change is at worst, at most, a distraction, and at worst could make things even more difficult. I think finally, I just say that, Mohammed, I will accept your argument that there's enthusiasm for the government now, because the government, rather like Joseph Stalin in World War II, has switched from an ideological approach to a more nationalistic approach that has wider appeal. Probably that's one explanation. But I would say that if there was a lack of enthusiasm for the government before, by the people whom you mentioned, the young people with no memory of the past, I think nationalism has been reinforced. And I don't know whether it's been reinforced among the various minorities, the Azeris, the Kurds, the Baluchis, the Arabs in Arabistan, in Iran. But I suspect it has been, because Iran has a glorious history, and I think they feel part of it. So the net result of all this, as you say, is probably much, it's probably appropriate to quote Admiral Yamamoto after Pearl Harbor, which was a tactical success, magnificent tactical success, and an absolute strategic disaster. And he said, yes, we've had a victory, but I fear we've woken a monster. Therefore, strategically, this was a great loss. I think in this case, the Israeli attack on Iran, for a variety of reasons, was a strategic loss. And among those reasons was cementing a negative image of Israel in the United States. Polling data in the United States showed that only 16 to 19%, depending on which poll you looked at, supported American support of Israel in this war. I think the damage to Iran is physical, but not spiritual. But the opposite is not true of Israel. That is, the damage was both physical, very expensive replenishment of very expensive weapon systems, and also spiritual. I note that there were huge numbers of Israelis who went to the Sinai as a means of getting out of Israel, even though they were prohibited from emigrating. They managed to do so either that way or through private aviation to Cyprus. So I think the Israelis, for the first time in their modern history, experienced what they've been doing to other people. That is, blowing up buildings, a sense of insecurity, death among civilians in the military. And of course, I guess the final point here is that they didn't fail to take advantage of the war, both in terms of increasing the ethnic cleansing effort in the West Bank and doubling down on the Gaza genocide. We now have reports from Israeli soldiers admitting they have received orders to kill people who are lining up for food and are doing so, that this is an official policy. And of course, Israel has again suspended all deliveries of food aid to Gaza, even though it's in desperate condition. During the ceasefire, people will turn their attention once again to the misery that Israel has inflicted on the people of Palestine. So I don't think Israel won anything from this. Mr. Netanyahu tried to use the war as an excuse to stop appearing in court in his corruption trial, but the judge said that there was no reason for him not to continue appearing. And that trial is coming to a close. So the irony is that in the end, the regime change may take place in Israel, not in Iran.
Professor Marandi, if we assume that, in my opinion, that was the main reason to attack Iran, they wanted to do so-called regime change in Iran. They thought that by assassinating these commanders, this head of military, they can achieve something within making it some sort of chaos in Iran. But many people, Professor Marandi, don't know. We know that we have in Iran various ethnicities, that they've been living together for many years, for centuries together. And what when it comes to the way that the Iranian media, as you mentioned, those who are outside Iran, that they're trying to help these think tank, these people who are somehow who are interested in what's going on inside Iran. They're giving a false picture in order to convince them that they can achieve what they wanted to achieve with the regime change. And it seems that was so much, Donald Trump accepted that, was somehow convinced that they can do it. That's why he tried to get along with Netanyahu. Do you think, what is the problem? Why we couldn't show the world the reality of the Iranian society so far?
I think it's largely because the West has had control of the narrative for decades, and the United States was the hyperpower, and so for a very long period of time there was a monopoly over the narrative on Iran, and they began to believe their own narratives. You have a lot of these so-called Iran experts in the United States and in Europe, but mostly the United States, who are hired at key universities, in important think tanks. They have jobs in all these TV, anti-Iranian Persian language TV channels or media outlets, or they are guests. They appear all the time on these shows. And then they get a lot of funding. They have projects. Then they have they invite senators and congressmen and women to their organizations, who get huge honorariums to appear. And they say the same thing. These people say what needs to be heard. They, the senators and the congressmen, say the same thing too. And so you have this narrative that's constantly being reinforced. And a lot of people are enjoying a very good lifestyle producing it. And so the United States, I think, and Europe believes its narratives about Iran. They don't comprehend the fact that Iran has a constitution. We already had the founder of the revolution, who was a towering figure, Imam Khomeini. When he passed away, they were saying there's going to be civil war in Iran. The next day, we had another leader. And we, during the war, we had the president and the prime minister. Back then, we had a prime minister, which in later on the constitution changed, and we had a first vice president instead of the prime minister. But back then, we lost our president, prime minister, the head of the judiciary, government ministers, parliamentarians, and all sorts of many, many thousands of people through terror attacks by the MEK terror group, which is based in the West right now. Nothing happened. The Islamic Republic remained in place. And therefore, right now, they thought, my assumption is that they thought that if they took out the leadership of the armed forces, that everything would fall apart. And not for a moment did I hear anyone, even on the first day, which was the darkest day, until the Iranians began to fire missiles into Tel Aviv. During those hours, never did I hear anyone say that they think that the country is going to collapse or that the country is going to capitulate. It never occurred to anyone. So we have a constitution. And even if in the years ahead, the leader passes away, we'll have a new leader elected. And what the Israelis did, and here, this is a really interesting point. Nationalism and religion in Iran are very much fused together. Shia Islam is very much a part of national identity. And of course, Shia Islam is a very powerful force in Iranian national identity. We are in the beginning of the month of Muharram. And on Tasu and Ashura, which are a few days ahead, you will have the anniversary of the martyrdom of Imam Hussein and his sister, who stood by his side and carried on the message as she was taken hostage by the despot at that time. And when he was being given a choice between capitulating to the despot and martyrdom, he said, "Heyhat min nabillah," and that's a slogan which everyone in Iran knows. It means never to humiliation, something like that. And that is a part of Iranian culture. Even though Iranians who may seem to be completely secular when it comes to Tasua and Ashura, they're all a part, everyone is a part of it. Everyone participates somewhere in the ceremonies. So what they've basically done is that they've intensified this sense of religiosity, especially, as I said, the grandson of the Prophet and Ashura, and nationalism, but they're not separate from one another. But they cannot comprehend this because they've been busy all these years saying that all we have to do is push. People hate the. They think that they believe their own propaganda. And while Iran is no utopia, if you go into any taxi or into a bus, not any taxi, but if you drive around, if you go around in Tehran in a bus or a taxi or in the metro, or if you go to shops, people will grumble. But the same people who grumble and maybe do far more than grumbling, curse, you'll see them tomorrow in the funeral. It's they don't seem to comprehend that you can be both at the same time. You know, I've said this to some of my friends. When we, people like myself, my friends, my colleagues, when we sit together, it's not a part of our culture to praise the government. No one sits down and says, "Wow, we have such a good metro system." If someone says that, we'll look at them and like, what, you know, what's wrong with this guy? That's not how it is here. It's never been this way, at least in my adult life. I've never seen this. People, we are by, I can't say nature because that human nature is a different thing, but we are, our culture is one, at least in the last four, after the revolution at least, it has been always to be critical. But that critical, being critical, does not mean regime change or hatred or animosity. And again, we will see tomorrow, although I think that many will choose to close their eyes and ignore the reality of tomorrow. But I think many others will see the reality. When General Soleimani was murdered by Trump, we saw millions of people take to the streets in Tehran, which is, by the way, the most secular city in the country by far. Tehran is the most secular city in the country. Well, and of course, secular means different things to different people. And I would, as I said, even on Tasua and Ashura, when they commemorate the grandson of the Prophet and the granddaughter of the Prophet and their resistance to the despot and their support for the deprived, and the, which is really the reason why Iran supports Palestine, because it is that worldview that makes the Iranians so adamant in, or Hezbollah or Ansarullah in Yemen, in supporting the Palestinians, because they see them as marginalized, as oppressed, and so on. But in any case, the point is that their miscalculation has strengthened Iran. If they were smart, they would not have done this. They had on paper, they benefited from the blitzkrieg. They killed a lot of senior commanders. They took out missile air defenses, and they caused a lot of damage and chaos. But they showed ordinary Iranians that the other side is the aggressor. They showed ordinary Iranians that the United States and the Europeans support aggression. They showed the Iranians that the International Atomic Energy Agency is a dishonest body that is controlled by the West, that will not condemn the bombing of nuclear installations. The West supports the bombing of nuclear installations, even though hypothetically you could have radioactive leakage where thousands of people could hypothetically die. But so Iranians see the cynicism and the sinister behavior of the West. And it's not just Iranians. Across the world, people are seeing this. Now, Trump can speak on television all he likes, but in Brazil and China and Russia and in the global South, people are seeing through this facade. People are sympathizing with Iran. And I'm on the media. I've been on the media a lot during the last 15, 16 days. And I really put aside everything and I'm just doing, I'm just on media. I feel it in the comment sections and the way in which people contact me from different parts of the world, including young Iranians from Europe and the United States, that Iran has suddenly become very popular. And the United States is becoming disliked, or the regime in the United States, the Trump regime. And young people from Iranians from Europe, the United States, contact me and say, I was wrong. I now see that the leader or the government was right all along about the United States, that you cannot trust them, that you cannot trust having an agreement with them. So the damage that the United States has done, the Israeli regime has done by this blitzkrieg attack, far outweighs the material benefits it gained by killing, murdering a few people and destroying a few installations. It was a colossal miscalculation. And I think what Chaz was referring to with regards to Pearl Harbor and the Second World War is something like that. It mobilizes an action when you, I mean, in the case of the Second World War, why Pearl Harbor happened, you know, Chaz could explain that and what the history was, and the United States wasn't all that innocent. They were strangling Japan. But in any case, it succeeded in mobilizing the United States. And the United States, of course, was much more powerful than Japan.
So you said something, Mohammed. Nima, may I?
Go ahead.
Which I think is several things which are very important. No one trusts either Trump or the United States to make a deal. After all, on two occasions at least, we've seen negotiations serve as cover for a surprise attack. Arguably, this was the case also with the Russian meeting with the Ukrainians in Istanbul. So it's a pattern. So when Mr. Trump says, well, we're going to have a negotiation with Iran, which he says, I think he's living in a fantasy world, and at least in terms of 1 week, I think Iran would be well advised to keep contact with the United States, and probably will, but contact is not the same as negotiation. I think your statements on Iranian national identity are really very important, because I recall you reminded me when I left the diplomatic service, I went to the now defunct, almost defunct U.S. Institute of Peace, and I wrote a book which attempted to do for power what Sun Tzu had done for war. Of course, I failed, but I hoped to start a genre of literature which is in the tradition of the Arthashastra, the Shahnameh, which I mentioned earlier, and other books about the doctrine of statecraft. This is called Arts of Power. And I felt that the first thing I had to do in that book was to describe a hierarchy of interests. That is to say, which interests are of so valuable to a country that it will martyr itself for them. It will do what Hussein did. Which issue? How do you rank these issues? And I concluded that there was a series of ranks. There were just ordinary interests. You know, I want to protect my citizens when they're running around in Iran. That's an American interest. There are strategic interests, which, if neglected, can become vital interests, meaning they can do real damage to you and frustrate your efforts to advance your country's wealth and power. I was persuaded by an Iranian American research assistant that the supreme national interest is the national identity. That is what people will are willing to die for. So I'm not surprised by the reactions you bring out. Let me make another comment on succession, because you also are describing the institutionalization of a political system, and why an institutionalized system as opposed to one that is entirely personalistic and ad hoc, which I'm sorry to say many of the countries on the other side of the Gulf have, that, you know, these this is a big difference. And you brought to mind again another incident. I was involved in China, trying to persuade the Chinese to work to persuade the Americans and the South Koreans to make peace with North Korea. And I got quite far. Deng Xiaoping was convinced this was a good idea, and we were seemed to be moving forward. And then the president of South Korea and 13 members of his cabinet were assassinated by the North Koreans in Myanmar, in Burma. It was very clear that Kim Jong-il, the son of the dear leader, the founder of the country, Kim Il-sung, was responsible. My immediate reaction, having been in Seoul and having met many of these murdered people, was, oh, this is a terrible blow to South Korea. How will it survive? And I didn't, at that point, I became aware that there were 9 layers of possible successors under each one of them. People who'd been to Harvard and or wherever and had economics degrees or political science degrees, or who had extensive experience that qualified them for leadership. And there was a seamless transition, which just underscores the importance of having a constitutional order, even if it's one that Americans might not approve of, a guided democracy, if you will. Some Iranians don't approve of it. But that brings me to my final observation, and that is, having read Alfred O. Hirschman's Exit, Voice, and Loyalty, a book which, if you haven't read, I strongly recommend. I see you have a lot of books behind you there on the shelf. But this is one that it's a short book, and it's brilliant. In the book, he applies economic theory to politics, and he identifies why revolutions happen. I won't go through the whole thing, but although it's not very complicated. Essentially, I would say, I can't, of course, describe what's going on in Iran, but in my own country, the United States has entered a pre-revolutionary condition. That is to say, the level of dissatisfaction, the disgruntlement, the alienation from the government, the disbelief in the capacity of the government to do what it's supposed to do, the corruption in the political ranks, the irrationality of policy in the service of special rather than national interests, is such that very few Americans are happy with the system. And that explains Donald Trump and his election, but it also explains the mounting opposition to him and the polarization in American society. So again, perhaps in projecting our own disquiet onto Iran, we are not describing Iran, but inadvertently describing ourselves. In any event, I don't think regime change has been a successful strategy anywhere. I think it was a great mistake for Israel to do this, to kill the possibility of a peaceful resolution of its differences with Iran, because I think the differences now essentially have become irreconcilable, and to set up a long-term struggle that I don't think Israel's very likely to win. Israel may have existed off and on over the millennia, hasn't really existed for 2,000 years, Iran's been there for 2,700 years, so at least. I remarked elsewhere that the Romans, whom I admire in many ways but despise in others, tried for 5 centuries to do in Parthia and failed Persia. So I think fooling around geopolitically with this kind of equation is not smart. And while it can cause a great deal of suffering to people everywhere, including in Iran, the people who start the war are the ones who probably are the ones who are going to suffer the most. You see this in part with President Trump's foul language about Israel, which is unprecedented in American politics. It represents a degree of alienation from that despicable prime minister that I mentioned, that is quite impressive. And I see also more and more people saying, I don't want anything to do with Israel or its wars or whatever. This is a trend that does not strengthen Israel, it weakens it. Even as you said, and this is my last point, during the conflict, the war, the active part of the war, because the war isn't over, as we mentioned, I think it was in Iran's interest to be transparent about the damage it was suffering, partly because of the very Shiite tradition that you mentioned, which glorifies suffering in a good cause, martyrdom, but partly because I think Iranians understood that they had the sympathy of the world as the party that was subject to aggression. By contrast, Israel was desperate to conceal the damage that it suffered from Iran's counterattack, to the extent that Ben Gvir, the security minister, one of the theological thugs who are in power in Jerusalem, argued that it should be made a crime to listen to or watch Al Jazeera. Nobody who's not concerned to conceal things could ever say such a thing about a news outlet. So anyway, you're on the media a lot. Please don't take too long an app and stop it. I think you have a willing audience, and I will shut up here.
Professor Marandi, you've mentioned that Iran is getting prepared for any attack in the future coming from the United States or Israel. We've learned that Iranian defense minister he's going to meet with Russian and his counterparts, Russian counterpart and Chinese. What is the main objective of these talks? Because we've learned that China was somehow shocked with the way that Israelis were attacked Iran. They're just taking notes from these sort of attacks. When it comes to making some sort of network inside a country, look at Iran. A country the size of Iran is so much difficult to find these networks. Just imagine what could happen to China if they go in that direction. What is the main concerns are on the part of the Iranian foreign minister, Iranian defense minister, to be talk with his counterparts?
Well, first, I just wanted to say I always enjoy listening to the words of wisdom of Chaz, and the more he talks, the more I learn. Actually, this meeting was supposed to happen anyway. It was the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and it came at a very ideal moment for the Iranians, because the defense ministers of not just China and Iran or Russia and Iran, but other defense ministers also would be engaging with the Iranians. And as Chaz rightly pointed out, there is a huge amount of sympathy for Iran across the globe, both in the public and among governments. And the public right now across the Arab world and beyond, you see huge amounts of support. I have friends across Latin America, because I'm regularly invited here and there. They tell me how the mood is so high. And of course, the mood is very hostile towards the Israeli regime. But of course, it began really 21 months ago with the start of this genocide, this Holocaust in Gaza. And so, but during the last couple of weeks, it has further intensified. And so people across the world are with Iran. And Ayatollah Khamenei has become a popular figure across the region and beyond. So this has been, this meeting comes at a very good moment for Iran. And the Russians and the Chinese are both tilting towards Iran. You can see that from the statements that they've been making. They are deeply concerned. The Iranian foreign minister, Dr. Araghchi, when he went to Russia, he said that the meeting with President Putin was excellent. And he, last night, he was on television for an hour discussing the situation. And I felt that he was very relaxed about how things were moving. And I have no doubt that the Chinese and the Russians, they are deeply concerned about the behavior of Trump and about the lawlessness of the Israelis and the Americans. So that will further strengthen the relationship between Iran and these countries, which, by the way, a lot of what we're seeing today is simply the result, or to a large degree, the result of U.S. policy. The Iranian-Russian relationship evolved dramatically after the events in Ukraine. If the United States had behaved towards Russia in a different way over the past decade, at least, we would not see the relationship between Iran and Russia reach this this height. And the same is true with China. You see the trade war that Trump began with the world, but China in particular, that has further intensified and strengthened the relationship between Iran and China. And so what we now are seeing today is that these countries are going to be more helpful towards one another, because a threat to one is definitely a threat to the others. And it's not just Iran, Russia, and China. The whole world is concerned about Trump's behavior. And if you've noticed, I mean, we've all noticed, but during the past few days, Trump has become even more erratic than before. The last 3-4 days, he's just constantly talking nonsense and putting out statements, and people are laughing. But also, it's a sign of I think, you know, it goes back to what Chaz was saying in a way of sorts, in this pre-revolution stage in the United States. You see the state in the United States, that is, that we look at it through Trump, is showing signs of greater instability, chaos, confusion. And this is not something that I am used to. Well, I was brought up, regardless of what I thought of the U.S. government, I was brought up with, of course, Chaz is older than me, but I was brought up with Jimmy Carter and then Ronald Reagan. And then, until Obama, at least until the end of Obama's reign or rule, you didn't feel this sort of, it was happening because, as Chaz said, Trump is the result of what was happening in the United States. The endless wars, the neoliberalism that began under Clinton and or even before him, but was intensified after the collapse of the Soviet Union and communism in the left. But in any case, what we're seeing now is a sort of a regime. What we're seeing today is a regime. Whereas 10 years ago, that's not something that we would have ever imagined coming out of Washington. We would have, Obama, regardless of what I think of Obama, I don't consider him to be any better than Trump. But Obama was a head of state. And Obama had a particular, he was predictable. I mean, he destroyed Libya. He helped destroy Yemen. All that aside, but as an individual, as a statesman, whether you liked him or not, you knew who he was, you knew what he was pursuing, you knew where he stood. But now, just over the last week, if you just look at what Trump's been saying, he's all over the place.
So the government in the United States is undergoing a process of delegitimization, and it is also being stripped of its competence. And therefore, it is becoming more erratic and unpredictable. And less admired by the world. So, in fact, despised in many quarters. I want to make a couple of points. First, one of the areas where Iran and Russia have acquired a clear mandate for cooperation is against Islamist terrorists. Because to the extent that they were involved in the attacks on Iran and in support of Israeli interests, or to that the extent that they have power in Syria, which menaces Iranian interests, it also menaces Russian interests. Russia has experienced great violence and many terrorist incidents at the hands of these people. So it's not just in terms of military supply and reconstitution of the Iranian air defense capabilities and perhaps technology transfer of one sort or another that will now strengthen between Russia and Iran. I can imagine that these factors have something to do with the apparent composure of Dr. Araghchi. With regard to China, a couple of factors are worth mentioning. First of all, of course, there is the example of the India-Pakistan war in which Chinese weaponry proved its value. And the Chinese, in fact, are, as I've mentioned elsewhere, in the process of expanding sales of their military technology and equipment elsewhere. For example, F-16s are being replaced in Egypt with J-15s. So China is now a desirable source of weapons that can hold their own against, in the case of India, the Rafale, which is a first-class European fighter bomber. But the most important thing here, it goes, Mohammed, to what you mentioned about the anger, the dismay at American lawlessness, Israeli lawlessness. The world that the people meeting in Qingdao for the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, or the people meeting in Rio de Janeiro for the BRICS in 2 weeks, want is one that is not lawless, that is ruled by some facsimile of international law. And I think what one of the things that the Israeli attack on Iran illustrates is that if Iran, and for that matter, Iraq, whose sovereignty was violated by the Israelis with American support, I shamefully add, if you are not able to defend yourselves, then there can be no law. Because up to now, Israel has enjoyed impunity through its backing by the West. Always, whatever it does is backed. So it never suffers any consequences for its bad behavior. It has just suffered consequences. I think one of the lessons of that for the Chinese, who are very concerned about sustaining the Westphalian model of international politics, is that it would be both right and proper and lawful for them to participate actively in strengthening Iranian and Iraqi air defenses so that Iraq is not a wasteland through which Israeli forces can move at will. I'm not speaking here about what Azerbaijan may have done in connection with this attack, but I'm just saying that in the end, the guarantee of law is not only its existence, but the ability of people to enforce it through their own self-defense and through coalitions organized to do so. So I think this is one of the things to watch is going to be great power relationships with with an Iran that is rebuilding and with an Iraq that in September will be free of U.S. forces, occupation apparently. One never knows about whether they'll actually leave or not, but that is the plan. So I think these are very important points, and I don't see people really discussing them honestly.
Yeah. Professor Marandi, do you have something to add?
Not really. I just would like to point out the importance of tomorrow morning. And I think people should keep an eye on the funeral in Tehran. And I think it will be a sign of Iran's strength and the miscalculation of the Israeli regime. What the Israelis and the Americans have done, as I said earlier, is that they've woken up a young generation that had a very, well, at least many of them, I can't say all of them, but many of them, a substantial segment of them, had a very different worldview than previous generations. And some of them, some of the most liberal are my students at my faculty. I think my faculty at the University of Tehran is probably the second most liberal faculty at the University of Tehran after fine arts. But and you can see, you can feel the shift. I can feel the shift among my students, but also you see the shift in society, and again, how people interact and how people, other people speak about their anecdotal experiences over the last couple of weeks. It's been fascinating. So again, this, what the last couple of weeks reminds me of the first year or two of the, or the first months of the invasion of Saddam Hussein, mm-hmm. where people mobilized to repel him and to defeat him. And he always, until today, he remains a despised figure among all Iranians. It's not something that will ever go away. And Trump and Netanyahu will, I think, for this this young generation, will remain despised figures forever. And it will take many years for the United States to be able to turn back the clock if it behaves in a different manner. So I, again, think that we are going to go into another phase in this war. I think that the Israeli regime, which has no red lines, will probably at some point carry out an attack. But Iran will be much more prepared, much more united, much more prepared. And as I said earlier, the Israelis gave it their best shot. They have the best weapons that the Americans have to offer. What the Ukrainians can only dream of having the weapons that Netanyahu has at his disposal. Zelensky would look in awe at what he has, what Netanyahu has been able to get from the Americans and the Europeans. So, but he's put everything on the table. He thought he would decapitate Iran and force it to submit. He put out all his collaborators, all the weapons in a blitzkrieg attack, and it didn't work. And so now the Iranians are going to be prepared. They're going to be devising ways to deal with that technology. And Iran has friends to help it in that respect. And Iran, of course, is itself a very advanced country, much more advanced than people in the West would like to believe. So I don't think this is going to end well for the Israeli regime. And it's just another nail in the coffin of Zionism, which and there have been many nails over the past 21 months, but this is a big nail, and it's going to, I think, speed up the process of delegitimization for the regime in the eyes of the world. And I think ultimately the regime is destined to fail. When that failure will take place, I cannot say, but I am confident that we are moving in that direction.
Ambassador, do you want to add something?
No, I think that is a fitting way to end the discussion.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being with us today, Professor Marandi, Ambassador Chas Freeman. Great pleasure, as always.
That's a great honor.
Indeed.